Austin, welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Wednesday, March 19th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites, the archive website llresearch.org and the community website bringforth.org. Together they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on the air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody with us and ready to go?
We are ready.
We are.
Ready.
All right. It looks like we've got a live caller ready to ask a question. Do we want to do the opening riff, or do we want to go ahead and...
Let's go to him. Her.
Well. All right. It looks like this is a... we don't have the area code, so we only have one live caller. Live caller, you are now on the air. Who are we talking to?
Hi, you're talking to Tabitha. And my question is, I want to know, do you ever see me getting married again? And if so, when?
Are you looking for like a psychic sort of reading?
Yes.
We don't actually do psychic readings on this show.
I'm afraid about several weeks ago. Somebody made a mistake in how they offered our number, and you're actually looking for another show that this...
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're sorry about that.
We're sorry, too. I hope you do find somebody.
All righty. So let's go on to our opening riff. Today's riff comes from a Quo session on October 23rd, 2010. What you experience as your personality is actually a kind of shell. It is a kind of clothing, mask, or costume. It is not a trick. That is to say, although it is an illusion, all things are illusory to one extent or another. Your personality shell is as real as you know how to make it be. Nevertheless, what you experience as your personality shell, or as some might say, the ego, is not the whole self, the whole of yourself, and was never intended to be a true representation of your soul stream.
Thank you, Austin. I have a friend brought up as a Southern lady and full of culture and hospitality and fun. People are always glad to be around Jane because she is such a blast to be with, so intelligent and so funny. She's a wonderful cook, a great mom, a beautiful wife. And before she decided to be an at-home mom with four kids, she was a very accomplished teacher who had experience as the head of a private school. I used to spend a lot of time with Jane because she was my ride to a weekly rehearsal for the Louisville Bach Society, a singing group that we both belonged to. One day she said to me, "I'm like an onion." And I asked her, "How's that, Jane?" She said, "Well, you can peel a layer off and there's plenty of onion left, and then another layer and another layer." She said, "Eventually you peel all of the layers off and there's nothing left." She says, "In the middle I'm nobody." Trying to say that all these masks that she had been wearing for so many years, the masks I just described to you, never really captured her, and she knew it. But she didn't know how to express it except by saying that she was a nobody. When you took all the masks away, there was nothing left. A lot of people feel that way, and they hang on to their masks. They hang on to what they do, to various things that make a person proud or give them comfort. So what's the truth? All the masks away. What's the essence that remains? I think that's one reason that meditation is such a useful tool. Because eventually that question does get answered if you meditate. It's with your essence. And oh, what a joy it is when you finally do contact the you that is beyond all the masks of this third density incarnation and find the spirit within. The spirit within that has no more need to justify itself and fly on the wing, or a flower in the midst of blooming. It is. And when you walk away from a flower, you retain that aroma. The beauty of the smell of a gardenia or a rose cannot be described. Closer to the essence of that entity than blooming of the outside, to have an abiding aroma that we leave behind when we walk away. Something that lingers in the mind of the people we leave behind. Truly are far beyond what we do or any of the masks of what the Kuo called the ego. The spirit within abides not just from moment to moment, but from incarnation to incarnation, then now in the future and forever, get away. We are who we are, and there is only one of us in all of creation. Just as no two snowflakes are alike, no two soul streams are alike. Two souls have experienced the same things or reacted the same way or witnessed in the same way. Relate to ourselves. Experience after experience. And from all of those gifts of incarnation, we begin to distill an essence that more and more closely matches the essence within, until we become love. People see us, they see the love before they see the person. May we all seek that essence, find that essence, and take the time to be. Amen.
Carla, moving on to our questions for the day. We have a question from Jim K. from the Bring Forth Forums. Jim asks, the Confederation says that one of the primary requirements to graduate is to accept that we know nothing. Now that Gaia has birthed its fourth density self, would you suggest that it is wise to continue this acceptance of not knowing anything for the rest of this current incarnation? Or are we now safe to allow ourselves the luxury of believing that we do understand some simple truths?
Has anybody looked this quote up?
No, go ahead.
No, I didn't.
I think what he's referring to is commonly quoted. Ra says, it is absolutely necessary that an entity consciously realize it does not understand in order to be harvestable. Understanding is not of this density. That quote is often referenced in the same way that Jim referenced it, believing that Ra is saying that we can't understand anything in third density. But I think that when people reference that quote, it's a little out of context, because the question that Don asked, which Ra is responding to, is he says, I am assuming it is not necessary for an individual to understand the law of one to go from third density to fourth density. Is this correct? So what I get from that is Ra is saying that it's necessary that a third density entity does not understand the law of one in order to graduate to fourth density. There are several times in the Ra material when Ra acknowledges Don's understanding of certain things, or asks Don to understand something, or points out the requirements to understand other concepts within third density. So I really think what Ra is referring to here is just the law of one. And I think what that means is similar to when they were talking about the poker game, when Ra says that you cannot remember your hand, their hands, or perhaps even the rules of the game. This game can only be won by those who lose their cards in the melting influence of love, can only be won by those who lay their pleasures and limitations. They're all upon the table, face up, and say inwardly, all of you players, each other self, whatever your hand, I love you. This is the game to know, to accept, to forgive, to balance, and to open the self in love. This cannot be done without the forgetting, for it would carry no weight in the life of the mind-body-spirit beingness totality. The forgetting there is, how I understand that, is the forgetting that we are one, the forgetting that everything is unified, basically the understanding of the law of one. And Ra is saying there that we have to forget, we have to not understand that everything is one for the choice to love to carry any weight within our evolution. I think that's what Ra is referring to, and that is a little off of what Jim asked, but that's my opinion.
I think that's exactly right. I think that the art of sarcasm is sometimes brought to a new high by someone, and I appreciate it when I see it. It's well sarcasmed. It's beautifully said. And I feel sure that it's more or less an intellectual trick, a question, shall we say, that that it would be fun to pose to us. And I'm so glad that you looked it up and went to the trouble to sort it out, because I think you're quite right. Basically, over half the people that are graduating their density never heard of the Law of One, have no idea about spirituality, and are just plugging along. But they give you the shirt off their back, and they don't think about the sacrifices they make for those they love. And never do they feel that they've gotten a bad deal. They simply love. And as I heard someone say earlier today, when you love somebody, you're stuck. If they need something, you want to give it to them. And we're all joyfully stuck in this incarnation by the fact that we do love and we want to serve those we love. So I appreciate Jim Kent's question in an intellectual way, but not in the way of the heart. I don't think this one came from the heart. I think this one was having fun. And it is fun. It's a fun question. I really liked it, and I appreciate it. And I thank Jim for it. But love is everything. And it knows nothing. I mean, it really, the phrase, a fool for love, is well said. And we all at times have felt that we are fools for love. That's for sure. But so be it, because that is the way of service to others, and thank God for it. Thank God for the energy that moves us to begin to take up the task of incarnation, which is to love and allow ourselves to be loved. Of course, it's harder to do that second than the first, but that pretty well sums it up. And think of all the people that you know that really haven't had a lot of education, they haven't had a lot of advantages, so-called, in our society. But they're wonderful people, and they love. They love with all their hearts. And they're going to graduate. So I think that it is fun to know, but what does the knowing get you in the end? I mean, I think that there is a sort of a collateral answer, and that is to ask Don to evaluate the value of this knowledge that is so valued in our society, because he was a thoroughgoing scientist, and knew a good deal more about how level, how electricity moves, how you know, light works to a certain extent, how magnetism works to yield us the energy that it yields us, that kind of thing. But Don was full of knowledge. He was a physicist. Ra was asking him to reevaluate that great knowledge. And in a way, it sort of asks him to evaluate the value of questions that move from fact rather than from spiritual principles.
I would like to add just a little piece here that I don't think is really in disagreement with what was said, but I would like to underline part of what Ross said, and that was that understanding is not of this density. And then connect it to, are we now safe to allow ourselves the luxury of believing that we do understand? I think in the third density, we have this personality that Carl was talking about in the opening riff that deals with the illusion, hopefully carries out the plans that were made pre-incarnatively, deals with catalysts in such a way as to gain experience and to achieve the goal of, you know, eventually in the third density, making the choice, opening the heart, and being of service to others, or service to self if you go that path. And I think that how that really works, we are not going to understand in this density because of the density. It wouldn't be to our advantage to understand, otherwise there wouldn't be any reason to make a choice by using faith. We would understand and make choices by what we understood. But I think we can understand enough or make enough of a journey down the path of understanding to get pointed in the right direction. We know that love is what we're looking for, that all things really are one, and that we want to open our hearts. But just exactly how that happens, I don't think we really have a good idea. And what we do is we go on previously chosen paths. It might be a religion, a cultural traditional belief. We get hints and clues from our predecessors. But we can only go so far down that path in third density. It's kind of like the quality of understanding is like an iceberg, and we only see a little bit of it here. But we can get a hold of it, and we can get oriented correctly and begin that journey of really seeking understanding. But in the metaphysical sense, we don't understand much at all. We just get a start made. And metaphysically, I think that once we're past the veil of illusion and are really ourselves in fourth density, we will discover there's a whole lot more to what we thought we understood. And that it just goes on and it has intricate twinings with other features of the universe around us. I think we will be in awe of what real understanding is like.
Oh, I feel sure you're right, Nikki.
So that's all I want to say.
Gary, what do you think?
Yeah, Jim was pointing to Ra is in a position to tell us what sixth density is like. And Ra also possesses expert, near total, I would estimate, ability with our language. So they could shape our language to communicate pretty much whatever they wanted to communicate, but still, sixth density so transcended language, which is pretty much our primary tool for understanding and comprehension on this planet. But the sixth density, not to mention aspects of fifth and fourth density, so transcended language that Ra could barely talk about it in a way that would make sense to us, to kind of put into perspective how far beyond the greater universe outside of the illusion of their density is, and how difficult that is for our third density selves, as Jim said, at the tip of the iceberg to understand. What about knowing and understanding? I've seen elsewhere in mystical philosophy that the phrase that goes something like, knowing happens according to the mode of the knower. It may not have that precisely accurate, but What that is saying is knowing basically arises out of or happens in accordance to the state of one's consciousness. And so you know what you know depending upon your depth of realization. And that depth of realization need not, like Austin was getting at, which I concur with Carla, I thought Austin hit the nail on the head as well, that depth of realization need not understand the law of one consciously whatsoever. It just needs to, like Carla was saying, love others, desire to serve others to what Ra describes as a vibratory rate of 51%, and then you, the entity is harvestable. But there's one other thought that's rattling around in my brain in connection to this question, and that's the difference between an analogy I've seen used to kind of delineate the difference between the absolute on one hand and the many on the other. And I'm going to try to stumble through that. And you've seen it used both in terms of the ocean and its waves, but taking that further, the knowing the absolute, knowing the oneness of all things is likened in this analogy to knowing the wetness of the water. No matter what wave you're on, no matter the size of the wave, no matter where you are in the water, at the top or the bottom, the fundamental condition, the root quality, regardless of space and time, is wetness. That's the all-pervading quality of water. So once you know wetness, you know water. You know the true nature of existence, so to speak. But the waves are infinite. The waves are many, and can thusly be infinitely explored. So I think within the confines of third density, it's possible to have that total knowing of wetness, so to speak, of oneness, of dissolving the fiction that things are separate whatsoever, and then finding the base condition of any moment, the eternal present moment. But maybe in third density, within the restrictions of this density, you don't see all the waves, the whole story. And it's interesting, and I'll wrap this up. I consider this, when I read the words of those who I believe are authentically, genuinely enlightened, Ramana Maharshi and Eckhart Tolle being two of my favorites, you see that same core mystical non-dual philosophy that is at the heart of the law of one. All things are one, being its most precise articulation. But you don't see with these entities like Maharshi and Tolle the cosmology that Ra shares. And I've wondered why they don't talk about the big outer stage and its many characters and the sort of drama, in a non-pejorative sense, that Ra describes. And I wonder if that is a property of third density too. A, you can find enlightenment here and dissolve the illusions, but B, there's still stuff, kind of the manyness, the waves, are still somewhat outside of your purview. But that's only a guess. Who knows what the enlightened actually see and choose not to communicate.
Yeah, little ditty. I am the bubble, make me the sea. I am the bubble, make me the sea. That Paramahansa Yogananda wrote gets at that too, you know, that there is the manyness of bubbleness, you know, of the wave, and there is the abiding unity of the sea. And do you know the sea from the waves?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much what you were saying.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic way to, in one clear, concise image, convey that dichotomy and the paradox of that situation,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that it's ridiculous to seek to know the sea, to know the waves, to learn whatever you can, because it's fun to learn. And why shouldn't you follow your bliss? Why shouldn't you have fun in the learning of what you're learning? There's no reason to deny yourself the fun of things. They're just so much fun. I think I'd be a student forever if I could take the time away from the rest of living, because everything that you open up by the second class, you've started to see a new flower bloom, a new piece of the universe come into flower, and it's absolutely amazing that there are so many ways in which things fit together, and fascinating, just absolutely beyond description. So, you know, why shouldn't you have the fun of knowing the waves? But on the other hand, beyond the fun of it, lies the source of the joy. And the source of the joy is that which makes all of these things fit together, that which makes them all one.
Source is a really good word to put into that exploration of thought. Because, like you're saying, you can go in, learning is endless, and you can move in any direction. You can go up, down, left, or right. You can zoom in. You can zoom out. You can proceed forward or backward in time, and it's that there is no bottom to it. And Ra says as much when they say something like creation is free to explore itself infinitely in the present. I'm probably butchering that, but that's the basic idea. And but as absolutely, like you're saying, fun as the dancing on the waves are, there's always one source. It's always happening. That whole outer play, infinite though it may be, is happening against one backdrop, and that's the present moment, which is always unbroken and permanent, and the fundamental quality of any wave and any outer experience and any learning. So the trick is to consciously merge into that source, and then to play.
Mm-hmm. Endlessly play.
Gary, you were talking about Ramana Maharshi and Eckhart Tolle, and I've always been a bit confused about their enlightenment. As you know, they both sort of just had it happen to them. It just kind of, one day, I think Tolle said that he was going to sleep and he heard a voice that said, you know, just relax and fall into it. Then he woke up and he was enlightened, basically. And Ramana Maharshi, something similar happened to him. He was on a spiritual path already, but it just sort of came upon him. And it seemed like from that point on in their lives, they existed in this permanently enlightened state, or Tolle is still there, supposedly. And I would connect that state, the understanding of unity, with the understanding that Ra's talking about here, that is supposedly not supposed to be of this density. They somehow have reached a permanent understanding of the unity behind everything that you were talking about, the wetness of the waves. They have this understanding of it, and they're here in this density. And so I've never quite fully understood that.
Yeah, you're right about how their, or at least within this incarnation, how their enlightenment experiences unfolded. I mean, a little more to it, but it was basically on, as kind of seemingly happened to them. They lived a, by all measures, a, quote, normal incarnation. Then all of a sudden, Maharshi in his teens and Tolle in his early 30s has this experience that befalls them, and kind of the blink of an eye almost, or over the course of a night, may have been a few days with Maharshi, they're on the other side. The individual I has just disappeared in both of them, and they each embark on a quest to further understand what has happened to them and be able to articulate it, but the whole thing kind of is fully there, already developed. They, with whatever remains of their transparent intellectual mind, try to get a sense of it, and then eventually communicate it to others. But like in terms of it just happening to them, that's been a question of mine too, because the Law of One and all spirituality talks about disciplined use of will and faith, talks about making an effort for growth. And here are two examples of enlightened people who seem to have a message absolutely, perfectly, exquisitely congruent with the Law of One, who don't seem to have done that work, but My guess is, and this is echoed in Maharshi's work, is that they did do a lot of work in past lives. I recall a Q&A with Maharshi where he says something like he supposed that he had done a lot of seeking. He didn't use the word seeking, like maybe study of philosophy in past lives, and he said it seems he didn't have a use for it in this life, and he expressed gratitude that he didn't dive into philosophy in this life because he felt it just would have confused him. Because when, from what I gather, when one is enlightened, then you don't have too much use for philosophy as a means to convey your quote-unquote understanding to other people.
Well, I don't know, because I had an experience that turned my life around in the blink of an eye and put me on the path that I'm on. And nothing has changed that in all the years since, and I was only 13 when that happened. But there you are with a full awareness in some ways. In my case, it was simply an awareness of the fact that I had a mission. And that still doesn't tell you anything more than that. You know, it's bare bones. Maybe, you know, you can drift on that and just be enlightened, maybe. But how much better it is if you decide that now that you realize, you know, your life, the shape of it, you decide that you want to discipline your personality. You want to make something of yourself in terms of becoming a magical personality. Not that you can learn anything about, you know, the context of your sudden enlightenment experience, but that you can fill in the blanks, flesh out the skeleton. And I find one thing about the Law of One is that it does that so beautifully. It explains why it is that you want to discipline your personality. I don't think that the enlightened state necessarily brings with it the discipline to do much with it. For some people, yes, maybe. But for most, there's that tendency to drift. And the service that you render is perhaps limited by the drifting.
I think that the disciplines of the personality, one function, one goal or aim of those disciplines might be said to organize and focus one's energies towards service, towards seeking, toward unity, because those energies, not only to organize them, but to make them conscious, to bring them somewhat under the direction of the conscious mind, not in a domineering way, of course, because the discipline is necessary because those energies, especially of the lower chakras, are wayward, and they are part of the conditioned past. They operate autonomously to some extent, or on their own, with their own momentum in any number of different directions, based on any number of different needs. Whereas the disciplines of the personality harness all that through knowing those energies, understanding those energies, accepting those energies, harness all that and organize it in a crystallized way to point in a trajectory. And in so doing, then the disciplined personality, the organized and focused personality, can penetrate higher chakras, can penetrate into new thresholds of awareness, and move further and further back into the source, into understanding who the self is. And thus that disciplined personality, which otherwise would be wayward and scattered, it becomes a tool, becomes a sort of weapon, almost, you might say, a tool that can be used to know the true self. In the case of the enlightened entity, my two favorites specifically being Eckhart Tolle and Ramana Maharshi, I don't think they have a personality so much intact anymore that quite needs disciplined, because I think they're in that focused state. They might be said to be constantly recollected, constantly one-pointed. Their focus is supreme, and it's permanent, and it's always in the now, always rooted in the now. No matter what happens, they are not identifying with mental forms anymore. They're not investing in a future or dwelling on the past, per se, but they're always this transparent expression of the now, of right now. And but nevertheless, they could, like we were talking, still continue to explore the waves indefinitely. Tolle, I heard him say recently in an interview that, you know, there's any number of different things he could still do in the world, including he wants to learn a new language, which he may or may not do. But he has recognized and discovered, and consciously his personality, his outer self, has consciously merged into that essential identity, which is permanent and unbroken. And regardless of his state of consciousness or his emotional waves, no matter what happens to him, he is in that permanent, fixed, essential state. And I think that is the difference there.
That sounds right to me.
It's a fascinating topic and one that definitely occupies my mind.
No kidding.
Any more to add to Jim's question?
I think that I'm done.
Alrighty. So we have about 15 minutes left in the show, so that should be enough time to cover this next question from user Aki444 on the Bring Forth forums. Aki asks, what is your opinion about this? I know it's not a question of quantity, but I think there is a correlation between the message of your logo, which is Don Quixote, the lonely and almost only guy in the desert, uselessly fighting with the windmills, and the relative low success of widespreading the raw messages.
Well, I think that it's backwards. I think that the Quixote logo expresses what the Law of One is all about. And what the Law of One is all about is a topic that is bound to be out of the mainstream now and forever because of the fact that it is not of interest to most people. Most people would find this whole area of inquiry vapid and useless, and would find philosophy in general that. So I just think that it's backwards. I think that the Quixote logo expresses pretty well our hope of seeking, and that seeking is something that is just not of fascination to very many people.
So you're kind of saying that the raw material is as a windmill to most people, while it is something more to the seekers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most people don't understand philosophy in terms of why is it useful. I can remember sitting in a philosophy class and having somebody ask on the first day, I guess he was forced into taking this class, didn't want to, and he said, what in the world is the use of this? How am I ever going to use this in life? I don't understand why people find this important. And I think that for many people, that's the simple truth.
Well, didn't Don Quixote feel that the windmills were evil or somehow had to be put in check, and so he was battling them?
Well, he was dreaming the impossible dream. He wanted to bring good and beauty and truth to the whole world.
Right.
And so that was, he saw everything in a very heightened romantic way that most people would say was ridiculous and was an illusion. But if you're familiar with the raw material at all, you know that
spiritual journey, that's what we're all doing.
Ra agrees that it's an illusion, but that it's nevertheless very important, of utmost importance in our lives. So it's an endless discussion in that it carries with it its own paradox. And
our chances of success are about the same as Quixote's against the windmills. But the important thing is we're both trying, or we're all trying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the intention and the motivation and the will and the faith that is really what we build after all this. And the windmills will still be here after we're gone.
That's right. But our interaction with them is all important.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Gary.
I like that Jim's inclusion of will and faith, motivation and intention. I think that Quixote, I don't know the story. I know of the story in the kind of Cliff's Notes version in the basic gist. But,
right.
Quixote became more noble on this quest.
Yes.
And like Carla was saying, the world would tell him he was a fool, and I think that's the case for the spiritual seeker. What are you doing? Why are you spending your time sitting cross-legged on the ground trying to concentrate? You know, why aren't you focused on acquisition of money or possessions or
walking the Appalachian Trail?
Yeah. which I would actually include as a form of meditation. But, you know, what are you doing with yourself? Why are you spending this time reading and trying to, et cetera, et cetera? And, you know, it's difficult for the world to understand. The world doesn't see what you see, what the spiritual seeker sees. So it's, that vision, of course, is available to everybody. But you have to, it begins with an act of will. It begins with intention. And I think in that respect, Carla chose a wonderful logo for LL Research. As to the logo's connection to the sparsity of people actually reading the Law of One, I don't. One could take a lot of creative license and draw some connection there, but I think the Law of One is about the individual, about the individual's hero's quest, you might say, to put it in Joseph Campbell's terms.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, Quixote is great. He's the protagonist. He's a hero.
Plus, I think that comparatively, for what the Law of One is, I think that it has been spread pretty widely. There's a lot of people, more than I would expect, that subscribe to this sort of cosmic philosophy. It's such a strange thing when compared to the rest of the world that there are a lot of people that do find use in it, and I think that it is a successful. Ra's intention in transmitting the information has been successful because I think it has reached a lot of people.
And he intended it to reach only the people that wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
He said this is those who wish a slightly more advanced approach to spiritual seeking or whatever, and that's right. And so then the idea that Don had was simply to offer it to those who might find use in it, and that's a very gentle way of advertising the Law of One. Hey, try this, maybe you'll like it. If not, that's okay, but, you know, give it a try. And that's it. That's the advertising. So it's pretty low-key.
Yeah, low-key may be an understatement. To,
yes, you know, but it feels right, you know.
Yeah, it's like Austin was saying, it has been spread around the globe, literally, except we haven't heard from the continent at the South Pole, but everywhere else it's reached. And like Carla was saying, advertisement has been low-key, so it's all pretty much word of mouth. But nevertheless, it remains, as Jim likes to say, somewhere between obscure and unknown.
I get a royalty on that, by the way.
yeah, every time I write that, I put a little R next to it.
I'm surprised at how many people are familiar with it and say, "Oh yes, I've read that. I know that." You know, it's in its own very quiet way, well known, but only to the group of people that are actively seeking. So.
And it's really interesting the way that people sometimes find it. I know you guys have told a story about somebody who was in a bookstore, a used bookstore, and it literally fell off the shelf onto their head.
It fell on their head. I swore to God that's what happened. It fell on their head from a high shelf.
And we recently got a message from somebody who said that it put itself into their Amazon shopping cart.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, they didn't know what it was, and it just ended up in their shopping cart, and they looked into it, and they appreciated it. So the Law of One finds the people that are really calling for it.
Yeah. I forgot to tell you guys that I clicked a button on Amazon that causes the book to go into people's shopping cart. Just kidding. Yeah, and what's also amazing, I think, like, how are you going to measure many people? And if you do so in terms of percentage of total population, total planetary population, we're a niche within a niche.
Yeah,
we're a tiny, tiny demographic. But what is amazing is the response that people have to it when they read it, that they suddenly, for some reason, automatically understand it, and it makes sense to them on a level that, like, nothing else has before. I mean, that was true in my case. There was very little precedent in my own background for it, very little foreshadowing, very little training or preparation, and then all of a sudden I read this crazy book, and nothing has since made as much sense to me as this philosophy and these words, and it's so true with many other people.
Mm-hmm.
Or with those, at least, who do resonate with this.
I think this is true of all spiritual material, in that it finds you when you need it. You know, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that the universe functions like that. Ra says... a couple times in the material where they say, consider this well. Consider the odd, I have such trouble with verbatim, memory.
I got it if you want me to read it.
Oh, yeah, please.
Okay. Consider, if you will, the path your life experience complex has taken. Consider the coincidences and odd circumstances by which one thing flowed to the next. Consider this well. Each entity will receive the opportunity that each needs. This information, source beingness, does not have uses in the life experience complex of each of those among your peoples who seek. Thus, the advertisement is general and not designed to indicate the searching out of any particular material, but only suggested the noumenal aspect of the illusion. Only to suggest. And that's actually talking pretty specifically about Confederation information.
Yeah.
The Law of One.
Yeah, thanks for digging that up. That speaks perfectly to what Carla was saying. When the student is ready, it will appear. But nevertheless, like, the agency of appearing, the mechanism by which the material appears, I think that certainly can happen of the self, by the self alone. You know, the self in a bookstore, the self shopping on Amazon. But often, I mean, each of us is fulfilling so to speak, the Creator's intentions, the universe's intentions, and we become faces and arms and eyes and ears and functionaries of the Creator. So it may be through a person. It may be through loaning the book to somebody that the student is ready, the teacher, in this case, the spiritually oriented material, appears. So I think, like, that idea of the entity will experience that which it needs, and it will find that which it needs, isn't necessarily at the same time a prescription to kind of sit back and be 100% passive and allow other people, not allow, but just not try to drop seeds where possible, if you sense that it's possible, in the thought that, oh, well, they're going to find what they need because that's how the universe works, or I'm just going to sit here and be completely passive. I think there's still plenty of opportunity to be more active in helping others along the way in that regard, with, of course, total respect for their free will, without even evangelizing or proselytizing.
Right. Someone asked me one time what I consider how I would describe myself, and I said I'm a snooze alarm. And, you know, what I meant by that was when I teach, when I get the incredibly fortunate chance to do so, I see myself as a snooze alarm. I talk about stuff, and if people are interested, they can look further, and if not...
Yeah, you're not going to be constantly blaring that terrible, terrible alarm clock sound.
Right.
All right. Well, we're quickly running out of time, so is there anything else anybody would like to add?
We love you all.
We love you all.
Happy spring.
Yeah, spring is coming. You've been listening to LL Research's In the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those of you who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, and we will be here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Talk to you then.
Search all day and never find anyone.